Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Joining me on the line is the head of Communications, Media, and Journalism Department for the University of North Georgia. He's also the executive director of the Georgia Film Festival, and I've known him for a really long time, and there are times that we equally hate cinema. Jeff Marker is on the line. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. We've known each other so long, it's really bizarre to hear you say my titles.
Why? You earned them.
It's so formal.
Well, okay, fine. Joining me on the line, Buckeye Dirtbag. Is that any better? Or
wow, you went there, didn't you?
No, it's not even. Have they started training? They haven't started. The pros have. I don't think college has. Although Jim Harbaugh is always in training, no matter what, as we all know.
That's right. Yeah, eating anything but chicken, right? Is that it?
I don't know. That requires me thinking about Jim Harbaugh, and I don't want to, or his stupid pants.
Let's not do that.
Okay. All right. So I guess I'll start the question with the obvious film that opens this week, neither one of us have seen, but are you interested in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Let's see. Everyone sit back and pour yourself a drink, and I'll tell you about my long and strange relationship with Quentin Tarantino. Actually, I'll shorten it. So, you know, you may remember way back when we were younger men, around the time Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction came out, you know, he was part of a wave of independent filmmakers that really led me to do what I do. You know, it was a very exciting time, late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, it just kind of got on fire with all these films coming out. And I thought he was brilliant for his first handful of films. And I think for his last handful of films, he's been indulgent and boring. You know, I mean, the first half to two thirds of each of Django Unchained and Inglourious Basterds are really great. And then I just leave nauseated by the last act, you know. So what to do with this movie coming out? This is an atypical Quentin Tarantino movie. That kind of gives me hope, you know.
But the Mansons are involved.
that's scary,
yeah.
Isn't it? So
yeah.
He's going to treat the Manson family. So I don't know. It depends on how it's structured. If it doesn't end with the usual unnecessary bloodbath, then maybe I'll be in. I don't know. Everyone is talking up the Pitt and DiCaprio performances. And so, you know, the best thing I can say about Quentin Tarantino is it's never dull. You know, it's always interesting.
I think I've always liked filmmakers that it either soars or it's a train wreck. You know, it's the worst thing to be is just kind of meh.
Yeah. So. Right. Don't bore me.
Right. Right.
That's the cardinal sin. And he doesn't do that. I'll give him that.
Yep. So, but we're going to talk about a different series in a little bit. But I do want to mention there was one film that finally opened in Indianapolis this week. It is the documentary called Maiden, the story of Tracy Edwards, who assembled the first all-female crew to the, was it Whitbread Round the World race back in the late 80s. Did you know anything about this when it was happening, Jeff, or since?
No, somehow I missed that whole story.
I do as well. We were both in college at the time, and I don't believe yacht races were big up on our priority list.
No.
But And it's done by Alex Holmes. And I've talked before with documentaries where, you know, every audience member has their own background, their own experience going into a film. And sometimes I downgrade a film because I already know the subject matter, meaning it's probably not built for me because I already knew the material. An example I like to use is the documentary, The U.S. versus John Lennon. I knew all about that for the whole time, but it wasn't any new information for me. But if the art house crowd or the mall crowd picked up on it, then, you know, bully for them. It's just I had to, you know, give it a decent review, but with kind of an asterisk saying I already knew this. What happens, Jeff, if you see a film but you already know the material in a case of a documentary?
Many times I have the same experience. I'm happy to say, let me talk about it as sort of a positive example. The great Buster last year, the documentary about Buster Keaton.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge Keaton fan. I teach film history. And so I kind of expected it to be that. Like, oh, this would be a nice clip show for those of us who already know it. But Bogdanovich and his crew dug up some new things. And so those are the nice surprises.
You mean film sociology guest Peter Bogdanovich?
Oh, I forgot to do that. Right. Yes, your close personal friend Peter Bogdanovich.
Let me pick up this name I dropped. Sorry, it's a Ball State training.
when you edit this, the little clip of him saying your name is going to be inserted.
Maybe at the end of the show. I already have the intro, but you'll hear it when it goes online at wfyi.org. So we'll get back to Maiden a little bit. The documentary is, from a structural standpoint, not the most exciting. It's talking heads and a lot of footage as the race was happening. That's probably the most impressive part. I wonder who was filming this, how they were filming this. You know, is there somebody on the crew? It was their job to record as the race was going on. So I think once the film gets a home video release, there will hopefully be a behind the scenes about that. But it's also a reminder. Have you ever went boating?
Yes, smaller boats than that.
But yeah, it's flipping hard. I think I'm the one that would want to be the rider as opposed to one of the drivers on this. So the fact that they have, and the fact that the majority of a big chunk of the race happens, you go to extreme weather conditions, especially when you're going from England to South America, and then you go from South America all the way to Australia for one leg. So you get extreme colds and extreme heat, and then sometimes there's just no wind. So. It's got a girl power aspect to it, obviously. They were not taken seriously at the time because the boating race world at that time was a sausage fest. And anyway, I found out some cool stuff about it, and there's some good footage. So if you get a chance, go look for Maiden.
No, I certainly will. Yeah, I haven't seen much about it, and now you've piqued my interest.
That's your pledge dollars at work right here. Speaking of which, also coming out on Film Movement is a film called Styx. It is not about Dennis DeYoung, and we're really okay about that. But it is another female nautical film. It's about a German ER doctor played by Susanne Wolf, who, according to the back of the box, won the German Film Awards Best Actress for this performance, going on a one-woman solo trip through the Atlantic when she comes across a ship filled with refugees. And if you've seen, there are moments of the film, and it's a really physical performance from Ms. Wolf. So at the very least, it's cool to watch that. There are elements to All Is Lost, which was the Robert Redford Boat Is Sinking film that I thought was the best film of that year. And there's also the ethical drama. There's more of an ethical drama because she is a doctor and she wants to help out the people, but the Coast Guard is telling her to not do it. And when you think it's going to turn into a Captain Phillips story, it fortunately does not. Although the ending, the look of the ending is very, very similar. So if you need female boat films, you got two to look out for. Styx is out on Film Movement. Jeff, appropriately enough, the only other video title of note that is coming out, Criterion, is putting out Michael Radford's film version of 1984.
Oh, my goodness. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Also known as, if I remember right, I believe the last film of Richard Burton. So, you know, there was that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, now's a great time to revisit the book and any adaptation of it. You know, we're living a large portion of it, so that's all I'll say.
Do we watch 1984 and then Idiocracy?
Or you could just turn on the news.
Or I was correct. Let me correct myself. The documentary Idiocracy. So that's better.
Right. Exactly.
So one of the reasons why I have Jeff on the show, because, well, it's been too long since I've had him on, but I recently picked up a couple of box sets for my in-laws. My in-laws have reached an age where they had to move into assisted living, and I got two box sets from them of films I've only seen one of. I got the documentary of the Thin Man series, and when I wrote online that I had watched this, Mr. Marker's interest really peaked up. Jeff, what is your history with the Thin Man film series?
Right. Well, Matt's being nice because he put that on Twitter, and I called him and begged him to come on.
You did not, maybe.
Well, like I said, I teach film history. That's my day job, and I think of The Thin Man as an example of one of those times when classical Hollywood actually worked. You know, this was a period when each of the major studios was cranking out 39 or 40 feature films per year and doing it all in-house. And so it was more like a factory than what you think of as a glamorous movie operation here. And so a lot of the films are just sort of done by rote and they're cranked out. And the fact is, The Thin Man was made pretty much according to that system. You know, so these are MGM films. The first one was based on a Dashiell Hammett novel. And it's sort of, you combine film noir with comedy, but it's a very particular representation of a sort of romance, which we can get into if you want to. And they hired all contract players at MGM. They hired Woody Van Dyke, who is known as One Shot Woody, because that's how many takes you got. And so they were able, he was known for just cranking out films of pretty good quality consistently, but more importantly, on budget and on time. And that's how this thing was made. And yet, the first one comes out in 1934, and I defy you to watch it now and not find it just as funny and charming as it was then.
Had you read the Dashiell Hammett books?
I've not read that one.
Oh, that one. Okay. It was along with the five films. There is also there's a supplementary documentaries, separate ones about Powell and Loy, and you know, they wound up doing 13 films together, I believe. But this was their. Go ahead.
I'm going to be that guy and correct you.
Okay.
They actually did six Thin Man films together.
Six. Sorry.
They starred in a total of 14 movies together.
Okay.
And to this day, they're sort of known as the most successful on-screen couple of all time.
Now, had they worked before Thin Man together?
Yes. Now, this is where I get a little uncertain. So
I believe it was Manhattan Melodrama. I think it might have been the same year.
Yes. And in the middle of making those six Thin Man movies, they appeared in other movies together.
Any of note?
Oh, you would do that. I'm blanking. That's
okay.
That I didn't make. You know what gets a little confusing is Powell and Loy were both so busy during that period.
Yeah.
I wanted to say Mr. Blanding's built his dream house, but no, that's Loy and Cary Grant, I believe.
That's right.
Right.
That is right. While you're feverishly skirting for that online somewhere, by the way, you're listening to Film Sociology with my guest Jeff Marker. What was fascinating was the fact that Powell and Loy, the studios were hesitant about both of them because they thought Powell was too old, and Loy had been kind of typecast as the exotic female roles, which is kind of a nice studio way of saying ethnic.
Right. And in hindsight, isn't that funny? You know, so yeah, she was in a Fu Manchu movie once upon a time.
Ooh.
And they had her, you know, as this exotic vamp. Which just doesn't suit her at all.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that watching the first one, and it's one of those that it seems like it was always on TV, and you know, TCM would play it, but they just had the right amount of chemistry. You mentioned it before. It's like if you combined a film noir with at times maybe even a Noel Coward play.
Right, exactly. Very witty. I mean, so many one-liners from each one of those films, but especially the first few. Hey, I'll circle back. You ask about another Powell and Loy movie of note.
Yes.
Everybody look up Libeled Lady, which came out in 1936. And this is – not only is it a good film, it's especially interesting because it's Powell, Loy, and Jean Harlow, who William Powell was married to.
Right. And there's also some sayings that it was loosely based on Hammett's relationship with Lillian Hellman. Do we know how true that might be? Or at least there's chemistry?
That one's hard to parse out. I mean, you know, the whole Dash and Lily thing is sort of mythic at this point, right?
Yeah. Well, except for your students.
Well, yeah. But that's my job.
That is your job. So now, have you shown The Thin Man to your students?
I have, yeah, on multiple occasions and in different contexts. And, you know, for film history, it's great to show because they think, you know, oh, 1934, black and white, that's a pretty tough sell and always has been for the decade and a half I've been teaching. And they laugh, you know, they get it and they laugh and it's still just fresh. Interestingly enough, I showed it in another class. It was more of a sort of cultural studies class. And we were looking at sort of how Hollywood represents marriage and couples over the years. And the students absolutely loved the relationship that Nick and Nora have because there's a complete trust between those two. You know, there's no jealousy, even though it's just sort of a running joke in the series that these young women tend to be around Nick. And every story they tell in all six films involves some ingenue. And yet there's no sort of... sort of jealousy there, but also, you know, I'm going to go to the great critic Andrew Saris here and pull a quote. He said that Nick and Nora were the first on-screen Hollywood couple for whom matrimony did not signal the end of sex, romance, and adventure. So you watch these movies and you think, good Lord, why can't all of our married lives be like that?
Right. It my version at home is occasionally my Mrs. Soce looking up from the computer and saying something along the lines of, you think she likes you. little dry.
Well, in some ways, this is not a marriage we want to emulate, though, because, you know, Nick is sort of famously a functional alcoholic.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There is a lot. there's one, and I think for a lot of people, I know for when we were kids that the film Murder by Death, because the characters played by David Niven and Maggie Smith are loosely based on Nick and Nora, as was all the detectives in that film.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, and you can look at this a couple of different ways. It's on the one hand, it's a huge compliment that Hollywood has never remade or rebooted, we say now, the Thin Man franchise. They've tried plenty. They've had it in development many, many times, and it just never pans out because you just can't replicate it.
Right.
But on the other hand, they've been trying to replicate it under other titles for, you know, 70 years now.
Yeah. And one of the special features was an episode of the TV series that had Peter Lawford. So,
Lawford.
And it was, you know, it was 22 minutes. So there's that. So the first film gets a Best Picture nominee. So of course they got to start cranking out more. Looking at all of these, you know, the last two are, but I think it's fortunately, it's the strength of Powell and Loy that you kind of keep going back. In spite of the, you know, the trickle down effect with some of the stories, you know, he goes to his home in the fifth film, and the sixth one is just, you know, it's you swing for the fences, I guess, but nothing tops the first. Do they go in descending order for you?
More or less, yeah. It's hard to match the first, but I think the first four are all very, very strong, and. You know, you gave me an excuse to quickly watch as many of these again as I could. And I'll even sort of stick up for the fifth one to a certain degree. You know, for the first four, they had Woody Van Dyke as the director and the same writing team for all of those. But The Thin Man Goes Home was shot either in late 43 or early 44, and Van Dyke had passed away
right.
about a year earlier. And so they've got a new director and a new writing team, too. And it's not a bad film by, you know, compared to lots of other comedies that came out in 1944, but there's just a lot of things that they drop that used to be the trademarks of the series. You know, Nick and Nora lead this very glamorous lifestyle in the first four films, but when we first see them in the fifth film, they're now riding in a very crowded train, you know, and they make mm-hmm. a joke out of it, but they end up being in the baggage car with Asta, the dog, and a goat and some other things. The action takes place in the small town where Nick grew up rather than the city, and so there aren't as many colorful characters coming in and out. But on the other hand, Nora gets probably more good scenes in this film than she does all the others. I'm not sure why, but she carries quite a few of the scenes in that movie.
And if I remember right, you know, there's always the kind of, you know, the gathering of all the suspects, and then, you know, William Powell gets the monologue and Myrna Loy gets an assist. And that one in particular is not bad, but, you know, it's still better than I remember watching Song of the Thin Man and the fact that they were trying to do it in a crowded nightclub, which kind of bugs me because everybody in a nightclub is absolutely silent while this moment is happening.
Right. The thing I do like about Thin Man Goes Home, you're right, they always bring all the suspects together. You can consider that a strength or a weakness of the franchise. We know how it's going to be solved, right?
Right.
However, they get a little meta, you know. Nora almost becomes the chorus during during that particular scene. And I quite like it until they blow it with a couple of really cheesy gags at the very end of that scene. And then they cut the credits and you're left with
that.
Not a great last impression.
Right. And did Asta make all six?
Yeah, he did. Same dog, too.
That's what I meant. The same dog. So, and how much did that dog make while working?
I don't know, but I think he's right up there with all the great movie dogs. You know, they use him in different ways. You know, he's just sort of cute and charming in the first one, and they give him a wife in the second one.
Yeah.
And have a little bit of fun with the wife and the pups and a neighbor dog that keeps coming in, right?
That's yep.
good stuff. But, you know, one of the other sort of set pieces in each one of these movies is after the crime has been committed, Powell goes into the crime scene or some location, but he's alone except for Asta is with him. And these are great showcases for Powell because you get to sort of see him thinking, you know, see him finding clues and working it out and going from one thing to another. But that's when he and the dog really seem to be like sharing a brain too. You know, it's really,
yeah.
It's both cute and it works.
And it gets, and especially those, Powell, that's the chance where Powell gets to do some physical comedy.
Right.
The other thing when going through these series, and this is for film nerds like us, are the people that pop up that you don't expect. Like Cesar Romero shows up in the first, Jimmy Stewart, spoiler alert on an 80-year-old film, but you know, he's the killer in the second one. Donna Reed shows up in one. Oh my gosh, Dean Stockwell plays the son. Keenan Wynn is in one. So it's fun to see some of the younger, these younger players before they got really, really big.
It is. In fact, that's kind of the highlight of the very last one, Song of the Thin Man. That's the one with Stockwell and Keenan Wynn. But along the way, if you rewind, after the Thin Man not only has Jimmy Stewart, but an actress named Penny Singleton is in that film, and she went on to star in the film adaptations of Blondie, the comic strip.
Oh, right.
And that's actually, people forget about that now, but that was the longest running Hollywood franchise for a long time. She ends up being the voice of Jane Jetson. You know, weird.
Yeah.
Shemp Howard shows up.
That's
in
right.
Another Thin Man.
Yeah, there's the one where there's a big birthday party, and all the unsavory characters all rented a kid.
That's right. All these convicts with babies for just the loosest of of reasons.
It's about the safest form of human trafficking. I apologize for that joke.
Yeah, and there's even, it even, you know, helps with the very end, with the climax, too, in a sort of more plot-focused way. Yeah, another Thin Man has the great Marjorie Maine. If you don't know her by name, you'll know her by face and voice as soon as she comes on screen.
Yep.
And there's a couple of other interesting ones, like Shadow of the Thin Man. Stella Adler is in that film, you know, and you know Adler as the famous acting instructor. Mm-hmm. She taught Marlon Brando and all these other method actors. Well, this is one of only four movies she ever actually appeared in.
That's right. She and Lee Strasberg could have done love letters.
Exactly. Yeah. And she's fine in this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then the last one I'll mention, in Thin Man Goes Home, an actress named Anne Revere plays a character called Crazy Mary, and it ends up being a surprisingly human and sort of layered performance for these movies.
Yep.
And Revere's story is really interesting too. And, you know, one of the reasons I love the series is if you know what you're looking for, you know, some context, it sort of tells the story of the whole Hollywood, classical Hollywood era. And here's another way it does that. Revere was actually a really prolific character actor. She won an Oscar for National Velvet in 1944. But then she just disappeared after 1951 because she was named on one of the Hollywood blacklists. She appeared before the House Un-American Activities Committee and refused to talk. She cited the Fifth Amendment. And what do you know, she was just sort of blacklisted from the industry for about 20 years.
So, yeah, these range from 1934 to 1947. I can't believe that went on that long. Do we have an idea why, when they picked it, when they picked why they wanted to do, when they wanted to do another one, or did they just have just have it in stock?
Well, there's some really good reasons for this. So they made, you know, the first one 34, the second one comes out in 36, pretty quick turnaround. Before they made the third one, though, William Powell lost his fiance Jean Harlow, and he survived colon cancer. So he had to have a colon bypass and had to go through radiation treatments, which were very new and even more painful then than they are now. And so that delayed production for about a year. And then Shadow comes out in 42. And then, you know, it starts to be 42, 44, and 47. You have to remember the war was going on at that time. And I believe Powell actually sort of enlisted in one of those non-combat roles at a certain point, and mm-hmm. And Lloyd was very active in sort of supporting the troops. And by the way, Nick's drinking sort of disappears in the 1944 film too.
Right.
And I think that was a response to the context. You know, it would have, the opulence of the earlier films and his alcoholism would have seemed a little bit out of place in 1944 after the country had been in war for half a decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So various reasons, various things along the way started to sort of stretch out the time in between productions.
Okay. Yeah, it turns more into the best years of our lives than the rollicking 30s.
Yes. And if anybody out there has not seen Best of Our Years of Our Lives, you really must.
Yeah, that's a must. So now it's old guys throwing titles at you here on Film Sociology.
Am I a grandparent?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Movies like Best Years of Our Lives.
I think William Powell and Frederick March could sit and pound a few back and talk about the old days. So
absolutely.
All right. So yeah. So if you get a chance, folks, I'm one of those old crusty guys. I own a physical copy because the internet cannot take it away from me. So look for the documentaries or the film series of The Thin Man out on Warner Brothers. And it's always on TCM. It seems like at least it gets an annual run on cable. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's about right.
So, and did you show us
the DVR? Even if you don't buy a physical copy, you know, use that DVR.
Fine, yes, for those who still have that. So, have you shown the kid this yet?
He has seen the first one. You know, for everyone out there, my child is 14. It's hard to get him to look at anything that dad likes at this point, but but no, he really liked the first one, and I sort of sneak these in on him when he's in the room. It'll just be playing, and he'll stick around for a little while and catch them.
So have you and Lish gone as Nick and Nora yet for Halloween?
We haven't. Who would know who the heck we were supposed to be, you know?
Well, it depends on the party.
We know Nora every day, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's, yes. Go to Atlanta. That'll go over well. So very cool there. Well, I want to wrap things up because we have, as we call the segment, Dead People We Like, because we never have time for dead people we don't like. Rutger Hauer passed away, and going back through his work, and I'll get to his pre-Hollywood days, but we were, Jeff and I are of a certain age that he arrived at a pretty good time between between appearing in films like Nighthawks and then Blade Runner and Osterman Weekend and Lady Hawk. But looking at his 80s output in the States, I think it's an underrated streak, because I think partly he was overshadowed by, you know, giant pituitary glands like Sly and Arnold. But he wasn't quite like that, even though he was making at times cookie cutter films. But he was always fun to watch.
Absolutely, he was. And it's interesting to ask people, you know, what, when you think of Rutger Hauer, which film do you think of? And for me, it's Blade Runner. But then you're right. You named Nighthawks, and that was another one that I saw very, very young. My father would tell you it's the Osterman Weekend, that Ludlum adaptation.
And Sam Peckinpah's last film.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And a couple of people I work with instantly mentioned Lady Hawk.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a really good streak for the eight. And the other part is he was one of those guys. It was nice to see him pop up in something like Chris Nolan put him in The Dark Knight, which in his trilogy, which was pretty good. But he was one of those. He was always working, even if I don't know the material that he was in. The last thing I saw him in was Hobo with a Shotgun. I'm going to tell you.
They made that movie, everybody.
They did. This was a fault. Yeah, this was a made up trailer that was, I think, won a contest that it got to be on the video release or something like that for Grindhouse.
I trust you. I can't remember exactly what the story was.
And
the film itself just sort of, you know, overshadows anything else I might have ever heard about the film.
Well, Hauer is one of those. He's like many other actors who've said, you know, if the film is good or bad, make sure you're always good in it. And he even, you know, he brings his gravitas to a film with as ridiculous a title as Hobo with a Shotgun. If you're thinking of the title, folks, yes, it's exactly what it is. I've had people on the show. My buddy Mike Perry has been on this program. He watched the film, and I will say there's a moment in the film that is what you and I, Jeff, have referred to as a deal breaker in our households. And it involves torching a busload of kids.
Yeah. It will not be shown in a marker or resonance.
Yep.
Again.
So... anyway,
but that film is a great example. I love that you mentioned that. He didn't care what kind of film he was in; he was going to give it everything. And that movie is also an example of he always seemed to be having fun, even when he was the heavy. There was something magnetic about it, and he was fully dialed in, and he was enjoying himself, and you knew it.
I wish somebody. I mean, he did get to do Lady Hawk, but he could have done a rom-com. If not here, somewhere in Europe, if allotted to. But I know a lot of his bread and butter were action stuff. Did you see, I think I've seen one or two of his films that he worked on with Paul Verhoeven. I know they worked together several times. How's your Verhoeven output?
So-so.
Well, so was he.
But Verhoeven is the kind of equivalent to Hauer, too. I often forget early on some of the movies that Verhoeven made. You're just always working and working in both Europe and America. And so,
yeah. So if you get a chance, and I need to chalk, I remember seeing, it was actually my senior year at the Ball State University where I can't remember which it is, but it's Rutger Hauer and Jerome Crabb. And I think Verhoeven directed it, but you know, one of the things he got noticed for is 1973's Turkish Delight. There was also Soldier of Orange in 1977. And then I think the last time he worked with him was Flesh and Blood back in 1985. I think that was Verhoeven's first English language film, if I remember correctly.
That sounds about right. Yeah, a really young Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Fresh out of Ridgemont High, Jennifer Jason Leigh. So yeah, and do you? How much do you take into validity that Hauer wrote the dialogue at the end of Blade Runner?
I have no idea. You know, I mean, who does know exactly? Do we have a script for that film? But I'll say this, that dialogue sticks with me as much as any single monologue in any movie I've ever seen, and it keeps having more and more resonance for me. If you have not to get too far into this, but if you have anyone in your life that gets to the age where they start to experience dementia, you know, memories start to be lost. And I hear that monologue in a completely different way now that we're sort of experiencing that in my family. And so it's a supremely well-written monologue, regardless who wrote it, and he delivers it perfectly.
He does. And it's... I was 12 when Blade Runner came out, and so the fact that it was kind of the advertisements kind of pushed it as a sci-fi action film, and it's not that at all. And then to have that, and not only to rescue Harrison Ford from falling, and then delivering that beautiful monologue in the rain, it put some question marks in my head, but it had to be there for a teenage knucklehead.
Yeah.
Also, just going through again, he worked on Eureka. The film that made Jennifer Jason Leigh taller, The Hitcher.
leave
that as that. And if you need a 101, if you need something before you actually watch the Blind Swordsman series, he did Blind Fury in 1989.
Oh my goodness. You are pulling, man.
I know.
I barely remember that.
And, of course, the original film version of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Surviving the Game. Surviving the Game is a beer and pizza film because you have a film with Ice-T, Gary Busey, F. Murray Abraham, and Rutger Hauer about, and it's the world's most dangerous game. You know, it's a hunting film where Ice-T is the hunted. And then, of course, it turns around. But, that's a really overqualified cast for a beer and pizza movie.
No kidding. How do they fit all of that charisma and testosterone in one film?
It's okay. Busey chewed it up along the way. If you get a chance, go find some Rutger Hauer in your film library over the weekend. Wrapping things up, Jeff, what have you watched recently, new or old, that we haven't discussed yet?
New or old... We've been going through the selection process of the Georgia Film Festival, so I've watched a lot of those entries. I have actually, this is random, but I'm planning for the Disney takeover when they launch Disney Plus.
Uh-huh.
And so I've been watching Agent Carter again before it disappears because I just will not subscribe to that service.
Okay.
And I like that series, and I think it got short shrift. I think it's much better. They didn't have patience with it. They didn't know how to get an audience to it. So if you haven't checked out Agent Carter, I recommend it.
Have you checked out at all Documentary Now?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
I just finished it. Man. if you're a fan of documentaries, and if you are, what's fun about watching this series on IFC, and it's, you know, Bill Hader and Fred Armisen and John Mulaney's all involved, and, you know, people in their circles and outer circles kind of pop in and out, is not only finding out which documentary they're making fun of or which documentary filmmaker they are making fun of. There's everything, you know, knockoffs of Stop Making Sense, D.A. Pennebaker's company recording, make fun of Michael Moore and or any other self-indulgent filmmakers where they are the subject line. It's really, really a fun watch.
Yeah, the episodes for me are not of equal value. Some don't work very well.
Right.
However, the ones that work are brilliant. You know that it's a parody, and yet they've... You know, before you know it, they've created these characters that you really do care about, you know, and it's, and they create some genuinely sweet moments out of these parodies that they're doing. It's really, it's a great inventive little series.
Yep. Do we know if they're going to continue with that?
I don't know. They do them with no fanfare whatsoever. You know, every once in a while you just go on, oh, there are more episodes available. So who knows?
Nice. So when does the Georgia Film Festival take place?
This year it is September 20th through 21st.
And where can people go for more information? Because we can build that Georgia-Indiana bridge right now.
Right now. GeorgiaFilmFestival.com. We are selling tickets through Eventbrite. If you are a filmmaker, submissions are closed for now, but go to Film Freeway. You can find our account there and look out for the submission periods next year.
Jeff, thank you so much for your time here on Film Sociology.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jeff Marker, the head of communications, media, and journalism at the University of North Georgia, and also the executive director of the Georgia Film Festival. And I'm happy to say, a friend. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. A programming note, Film Sociology will be on vacation for the next 2 weeks. I will explain when I get back. So go see a good movie. There's plenty out there. And if you can't find any in the theaters, go online, find some streaming, or own a physical copy. Either way, you'll be fine. But we'll be back in about 3 weeks. But I want to end this week's show with a little bit of the Meters. Musician Art Neville, a keyboardist and one of the founding members of the Neville Brothers, passed away earlier this week. He was also a founding member of the Meters. And when I think of films and the Meters, I think of the song from 1969 that was used brilliantly in the film, the Quentin Tarantino film, Jackie Brown, their signature tune, Sissy Strut. So we're going to end with a little bit of the Meters this week. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!